Welcome to Two Men in the Middle, Democracy in Flyover Country. From here, we'll discuss today's topics from a Midwestern perspective with our boots firmly on the ground in a red state. I'm Mike McCammon.
I'm Craig Huey.
This week's topics, North Korea, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and Trump's legal team. Good morning. Good morning.
Live from the Two Men in the Middle. My ability to talk...
I've noticed that as I've been campaigning that I am beginning to shave words and syllables off of my phrases.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's because I've just told the same stories more than once and I'm trying to get through them, or the other excuse would be that I'm getting older and I can't remember things, and so I'm actually purposely trying to get it out of my head and through my mouth before I forget, if that makes any sense.
Oh, absolutely, that makes sense. So normally when you're talking, if you're doing a speech or you're giving a presentation, you've got the audio playing kind of in your head 10, right. 15 seconds before it comes out of your mouth. Do you find that as you're campaigning, and to your point, a lot of this can be repetitive. A lot of this, you're going on small amounts of sleep, or your work schedule has changed. Do you find that the problem is you're sitting there talking and suddenly your audio track runs out in your head and you realize after I get these next four words out, I got nothing?
Well, no, actually the goal here is always to not have a Marco Rubio moment. So, like at the debates, you remember, like when he
grabbed the water?
No. When Rubio was talking at one of the debates, and like he kind of like froze, and then he like played another track in his brain out through his mouth that he had just said like 2 minutes before. Do you remember that?
I remember that.
You do?
I don't.
Oh well, it was a moment where, like, that was the end of his campaign. That night he was like, whatever his phrase was.
Are you talking about Perry from Texas?
No, Perry
from Texas is the one. I'd cut three departments, and he named two, and he's like, and I forgot the third.
In fact, well, one of my campaign volunteers has said, never ever start a comment by saying, and here are the three things, because that would be the problem.
Yes.
You get to the third one, and your brain runs out.
It was the IRS, the EPA, and some other mystery. Department of Education. After he floundered around for a while, he just picked another one out and cut it.
You know, it's terrible in a way that we do judge candidates by... We judge candidates by their ability to memorize information,
yeah,
and to gracefully like say it in a way that sounds coherent, like a movie. But it's not that easy. Actually, it's not really that easy.
So we've talked about, as a candidate, one of your not your as all candidates, one of their fears is doing something off script that has a negative impact.
Oh, yeah.
on their candidacy, yeah. And that's why. A podcast like this, where we do take a long format, just opens up all kinds of potholes.
And it may be surprising to all of our listeners, but this is not scripted. I mean, we don't spend 5 hours typing a script to come in here, because otherwise, if we scripted it, Little Debbie's would never make it. It would not make it to the cut.
You're letting the cat out of the bag that we don't have professional writers and all
yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't mean to exaggerate. We have a whole team of people working on this thing.
So literally...
We're just to the talent. We show up and just read the script.
I scratch a few notes on my phone. You used to scratch some notes, but now you've got all kinds of other things going on.
I use that 20 minutes of my life to sleep. So that's what I use that
so
for.
Let's start with campaign update for the week.
You know, I wish there was some really big news. There isn't, really. We've been doing some polling, and not surprising, healthcare is kind of coming back pretty strong.
Yeah.
On all the segments that we've been talking to. And you know, I told you earlier, I went to the GM plant on a tour. That was pretty cool.
I saw that.
On Tuesday, I think it was. But, you know, my goal has been to be pretty much everywhere in the district, and the number now is 115 one-on-one face-to-face meetings since I got into the campaign in February. And I'm pretty confident that I've met with more people in leadership in this district.
Absolutely.
Than probably all the other candidates combined, quite frankly, just because I've just been, that's what I've been doing. And so it's great. And, you know, and you begin to connect dots. I was telling someone this, the story last night. I said, and you know, and someone kind of pushed back on it a little bit. So I'll just be, you know, whatever. I said, the Kansas City, Kansas Public School District has the exact same problem that Burns and Mac has. Can you guess what that is?
Oh,
and of course, now if you're not from around this part of town, Burns and Mac is a big engineering firm and like very successful one at that.
customer acquisition, VC. I'm thinking of this from the Burns and Mac side. VC, attracting talent, retaining talent.
Attracting talent is one of the ones, and that is a core problem in both, but the fundamental problem is continuity of funding. So in both cases, the Kansas City, Kansas school district, like a lot of school districts in Kansas, there's a lot of uncertainty around the funding for next year and the next year after that because the Kansas legislature has been playing around with the formulas and all that kind of stuff. And the Blue Valley School District, I'm sorry, not the Blue Valley, the Kansas City, Kansas School District doesn't have a big endowment or foundation like the other schools in the south part of the district in South Johnson County that have more money.
Yeah.
That can actually basically like make sure that they know they can pay their teachers when they show up for school in the fall. And the other problem is Kansas City, Kansas Public School has, challenge they have is they have older infrastructure. So they've got to be repairing old buildings and
they got more capital costs.
I was at Wyandotte High School and like the bathrooms don't work on the third floor because there's no water up there because they haven't fixed, you know, so.
Yeah.
And it's like that would, like if that happened in South Johnson County, like parents would pull their kids out of school.
Oh, there'd be 75 parents making phone calls and that'd be it for that.
And by the way, I live in this part of town, so don't, you know, I'm not trying to be critical of other people. I'm being critical of ourselves and how we look at the world through first world lens.
Yeah.
But the point, and then when you come to Burns and Mac, I mean, their problem is that, you know, they do a lot of federal budget and federal projects. And so like there's no budget, there's a continuing resolution only. And so they don't know about the funding and then it's a new fiscal year. And so like for them to like have, you know, for them to have a successful business, they need to know like what the world's going to look like a couple years from now. And it's difficult for them to get that kind of point of view with the way the budgeting is done at the federal government level. So at the end of the day, and actually I was talking to someone else about this, that this continuity, and I'll even just kind of layer it off one more piece, but continuity is actually the fundamental problem on all of these issues. You know, the health insurance marketplace, continuity is one of the problems there. Hospitals don't know, you know, what's next year going to look like when it comes to health insurance. Health insurance providers, like, what's the law going to look like? And then people are trying to make job decisions about leaving jobs or staying jobs. So continuity is like one of the things that kind of keeps the world going. And, you know, the no drama Obama period of our history was good because people, you know, there wasn't like this ongoing shit show going on that they don't know what's going to happen next. And by having that ongoing shit show, it makes for great entertainment. You know, the news business is probably better now than it's ever been because there's people always want to have commentary.
It's at an all-time high for me.
And look at all the money we're making off this podcast.
I mean sponsorships are rolling in, Mike.
Not yet. But
we're being very selective is the problem.
Well, that's true. You know, you want to make sure you have good brand alignment. You don't want to like,
yes.
you don't want to take just the first one that comes. You want to take the right deal, the good fit. But anyway, so that's been interesting. And then I'm trying to think of anything else that's top of mind.
But not much. I would push back that the one of the core concepts of capitalism in our economy, and this is where this doesn't work well for schools, is disruption. We don't want too much continuity because you don't want the big player settling into the groove that forces all the little players out or doesn't force them to be innovative.
Well, that's
so
fair.
So if every 2 years you know the apple cart's going to be upended, it keeps Burns and Mac on their toes. It keeps them reinvesting. It keeps them going. But you're right. For a school, I don't know about district. That analogy because it's two totally different entities.
What I was trying to convey to people when I tell that story is that you don't see those types of connections unless you're meeting with lots of people. You know, if you're only like, because what I've learned is that most candidates in this field as well, basically, I don't know for sure of this, but I know some have a policy person that writes these documents up. And they memorize 10 talking points for every different item.
Yeah.
And then it's literally, if I ask you a question about how's the weather, you go into your four talking points on about weather. I mean, there's no humanness. There's no, hey, I've seen this and here's a story. Here's something someone told me, or here's something I saw when I just was wandering the hall there.
Or here's one. Here's what I think about that.
Well, true. And the thing that I also don't see is I don't see people being vulnerable and saying, hey,
absolutely,
I don't know. Or, you know, in fact, I've had a lot of meetings that usually start off with, well, explain to me how that works. You know, because like we were talking, I was over with the mayor of Olathe, Michael Coleman, on Monday night, I think it was. No, it was Tuesday night. And, you know, we were talking about infrastructure and, you know, like interchanges and getting federal money for that stuff. And I'm like, you know, explain to me how that works.
Yeah.
And I would think that there's just not that, and I would call it almost a level of confidence that say, I don't know, help me understand.
Absolutely.
That a lot of candidates, and actually in life, I think a lot of people don't like to admit they don't know something. And so anyway, so it's been great. And that one of my big things is to lay down the track that, hey, I'm everywhere. And I have been everywhere. And there was something I was going to bring up, which it'll probably come back to me.
This is part of that disconnect we went through earlier.
Right. Exactly. With my brain and my mouth.
But aren't candidates at this level and even local level at all levels, they're learning that from the top up. I mean, if you look at that whole thing, stick to your talking track.
Talk to these points.
No matter who asks, what is the question? You just kick back to your prepared talking statements and you stay.
Well, you know, there's all this advice that says, you know, here's how you're supposed to do it, and there's a, you know, there's like an unwritten playbook and all this kind of stuff, yeah. And you know, I keep telling everyone, I'm like, hey, look, I'm looking at Congress right now, 535 members, and I'm looking at the Dems, and like, we don't have half of those seats. So yeah. it looks to me like the playbook doesn't work over half the time. In other words, so following this playbook of how you're supposed to do things, I'm not convinced is the right way to do it. And of course, I'm trying to prove that wrong. Now, I will tell you, I do show up at events with talking points. I mean, I'm not just going.
I'm giving Mike tips. Yeah, while he's talking. I'm making aggravating hand gestures at Mike while he's trying to talk.
Yeah, my volume went down because I drifted where I was looking. And I do walk into events or candidate forums or meetings with like ideas and things I want to talk about. But I also tend to allow myself to go a little off script. Well, I always go off script. I mean, to say I go a little is not true. I always go off script because I want to show people what I really am as opposed to just some cardboard cutout of myself, if that makes any sense. Here's one story I'll quickly tell. I've been telling, and this actually has been playing pretty well. So in this particular district, Kansas 3rd, 41% of the people that live in this district that are registered voters are Republicans.
I thought it'd be higher than that.
I thought it was too. 29% of the electorate is registered Democrats. If you add us and the Libertarians together, we're still smaller than the unaffiliated voters. So
I'm sorry, say that again.
If you take the Democrats and the Libertarians and add them together, we are still smaller than unaffiliated.
So there is an actual, the number of Libertarians that are registered Libertarian is actually registrable in this?
Yeah, there's four parties. Technically, you can register in Kansas. There's Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, and unaffiliated.
How many Libertarians are there?
Oh, it's a small number. Okay. But the point is you add them together and us together, we're still smaller than unaffiliated. The point here is that 30% of the electorate is unaffiliated. Yeah. They don't belong to a party, technically. So what I tell folks, and this has actually been working, because I believe there's a great sense of overconfidence in the party, nationally and locally, that the blue wave is coming, and we can just put anybody up on the ballot in November and they'll win because there's so much distaste and dislike for, you know, our current legislators or our president. But I keep telling everyone, I said, okay, that might be true in other places, all right? But I tell folks, when you're standing in line in the grocery store, look at the person in front of you and look at the person behind you. And remember, you're the only Democrat, all right? So for us to win in November, we have to find someone that can appeal to the other side.
Absolutely.
You can't just go in and say, okay, well, we're going to turn left as far as we can, and we're going to go all the way over into this other place that is just intolerable for unaffiliated and Republican voters. Now, you could do that in deep, deep, deep blue areas, like, you know, I don't know, just say California or New York or someplace like that. But this is not that kind of a place. This is very much a moderate and mostly Republican district, and you're going to have to kind of appeal to those people or you will lose again, and we will have Kevin Yoder as our representative.
I think the three things that give confidence to the blue wave is, number one, midterms, this always happens. I mean, you can go back 50, 60 years, and that pattern is pretty consistent, that if there's three parties in charge, that usually if one party owns all three branches of government,
right,
it only lasts 2 years. There's a natural backlash to that.
Right.
Number two, I think maybe this is where we're putting a lot of eggs in this basket. There is no way 54% of college-educated white women are voting Republican. In a protest vote, they will vote for anybody other than the R.
Yeah, and I think I do believe that the Democrats are going to pick up the House. I think they're going to sweep absolutely. The House.
And so, third, African American turnout will be high.
And I'm focusing when I make this comment about
you're focusing on the third,
the Kansas third. Yeah. The Kansas third is a moderate, mostly Republican district. And for us to have a Democrat win, they have to have a very moderate agenda. They cannot be too far to the left.
I agree. But those three things, I got to think, are working for the third. Number one, just this is a repeatable pattern in politics that repeats consistently.
Right.
Two, you've met with more women voters probably than any other person running for Congress in the third right now. There has to be this low level, medium level, high level energy to vote against the Republican Party would be my guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think generally speaking, well, you know, there's kind of a selection bias here. So someone's not going to take my meeting if they're ardently, you know, against the potential people running. Now, I will tell you what's interesting. I've had a remarkable level of success meeting with people that clearly are not Democrats when it comes mm-hmm. to mayors around town or police yeah. chiefs. I mean, clearly these are not people that we share, that I share like a political, that we agree on these issues. But so there's a willingness to talk. And I also think there's a pragmatism in the Midwest too, that, hey, you know, we have to kind of get along and, you know, I may have to work with this person, so it might be good to meet the person to begin with.
Sure,
and,
absolutely.
And we're like that out here. So I know it's been a lot. Well, I keep telling everyone it's a lot of fun. And I tell the story every single week, or did I tell it last week? 80% of it, I've said the 80-20 rule.
Yeah, right. Is enjoyable. 20% of it just sucks.
Just awful.
Yeah.
So, and the awful part is fundraising, without doubt.
I would be very surprised if the Democrats don't take back the House. And again, when waves will. Come, it's 40 to 60 seats.
They will, but I just don't, I really don't see, I just want to, well, I think that people can get overconfident. And that's usually when you get out over your skis, then that's usually when you fall.
Yeah.
So let's take a deep breath and say, okay, let's relish in the opportunity to take back this seat in this district and be very calculated about how we're going to make that happen and not just be overconfident and fat, drunk, and happy that it's just going to happen.
Yeah.
And we can go to these places that are danger places that would actually risk the likelihood of us winning the seat in November.
So what's our primary? What is your kind of interpretation or gut feel for female voters right now, where they stand? How is all of this impacting psyche of the female voter?
I try to be, well, you know me pretty well. I try to be pretty blind to that because I think, again, at the end of the day, it gets down to issues. And so the question is, what are the issues that women care about?
But doesn't this come to character is what
I think character plays a role in it. I think that, you know, do you have a life story that says, you know, women have been important in your life and have shaped your views? And usually that's a reflection of how you live. So, you know, I talk about, by the way, I think healthcare is a big thing.
Absolutely.
For that audience, obviously the gun thing and education. I mean, these are all issues that I think we all genuinely care about. I don't think there's a sex or gender that plays a role into what we care and don't care about.
Being cynical here. But isn't the easier thing to galvanize support around is that Trump's a pig?
Yeah, well, I mean, the sad news is this is no longer news to people.
No, this is a known known.
He is a pig, and he's that's really bad for me to say that, isn't it?
How else are you going to say it?
Well, you know, it was interesting. I was at this event last night, and we were talking about civility of conversations.
Yeah.
And while we want to be, you know, repulsed by how the president acts, you know, we also have a responsibility to ask ourselves, does that make it fair for us to behave the same way? And so it's kind of like, you know, I'm disappointed. I'll say it that way. That's a better, more political way to say it, which is true, in more of a healing, you know, religious way. That I'm disappointed that, you know, he can't find it in his heart to do the right thing a lot of the time and just keep his mouth shut. But nonetheless, I think that when it comes to women, I think there is obviously a lot of women, not all, but some, who are very energized by the fact that they want to have more representation in terms of their sex.
Sure.
I think that's true of minorities as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I also think that, you know, take any one of my own characteristics and ask yourself, is that represented in Congress? So, for instance, you know, I have an adoptive family. It's a multiracial family. Like, are there a lot of people that do that there? I don't think so. So, I mean, I don't want to make it about me and what my agenda is. I want to make it about what I think we need to get done, because at the end of the day, that's kind of what you go for, is to try to get things done and not necessarily represent. I know we disagree on this, but yeah. But nonetheless, that's the campaign update for today. And we should probably get on to more interesting things like North Korea.
Is North Korea going to be more interesting than this?
Well, I don't know.
I feel like I'm more excited about to talk about North Korea than you are.
You know, just a disclaimer for the podcast here, for all of our devoted listeners who have stuck with us for, you know, even more than two episodes. You know, Craig's in this other place. Like, Craig has this thing, which I'm not familiar with. I think it's called free time. Is that what they call it? And so Craig spends a lot of his free time, like, getting up on these national issues.
100% correct.
and when it comes to free time, which I don't really have, like, free time.
Free time for you is sleepy time.
Free time is, I've sat down in my comfortable chair right that I can see from right here in the family room, and I start working, and after about 10 minutes, I set my computer aside. Exactly. And then it's 30 minutes later, I wake up, I'm like, man, that was the best. That was the best free time. So so when it comes to all the big national issues, Craig's our guide,
I just have more control of my time.
Yeah, well, no. The argument is we all have control of the time. We just choose how we're going to spend it. And so I choose to spend my time editing videos. And
yeah, there's a lot that goes into that.
And I'll tell you what, I've driven, like, I was looking at the mileage. I think I've driven like 5,000 miles in the last 2 months.
Can you claim all that and write it off on your taxes or something?
I'm pretty sure I can. We're keeping track of it, because there'll be a moment when I'll probably submit that expense report, if you will.
a nice side benefit of running for Congress is you're going to get audited by the IRS.
Well, actually, there's a whole big packet of stuff I need to get to the House of Representatives by the 15th of May. That's a full financial disclosure.
That's got to be fun.
Well, I've looked at it, and it's not going to be
fun. No, there's nothing fun about that.
Now, I was actually impressed that they asked so much of that information. I'm quite nervous, of course, who's going to have it. But it's about your investments and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. It's obviously an ethics thing. But, you know, I don't understand why I have to do all that and the president doesn't have to do anything.
Just refuse to do it.
Yeah.
Just say, that doesn't apply to me.
Yeah, he's probably, I wonder what his net worth has increased since he's been in office. I'm sure it's been quite good.
It's gone up.
I'm sure it has. All right, well, let's take us on the journey of the national issues that I can't pay much attention to. We'll start with North Korea, and I'll just interject an opinion here or there.
So I was listening to something, and in one of my large swaths of free time that I enjoy, Mike, I was listening to something, and somebody made a comment about, they were talking about North Korea and the summit that's coming up with Trump, and how problematic this can be. And that there's a lot of things that go into this. There's so many moving parts to this. This can fall apart in any number of ways, but there's also a huge upside to this. And
upside for who, us?
Well, for us, for Korea. There's upside for China. I mean, there's so many moving pieces to this, and people that are trying to angle for some sort of kind of for this to end in a way that's beneficial to them. And somebody on this panel I was listening to, I think it was on MSNBC or a podcast, said, well, so few Americans don't know the history of the Korean War, and how that Korean War and our actions in the Korean War have set up, you know, 50, 60 years of hatred of North Korea towards the United States. And I kind of stopped and said, well, I don't really know anything about that either. That kind of inspired me to, let's look some of that stuff up and let's try to educate ourselves.
So you ran down to your local public library.
I did. Whipped out my Platte County library card, fired up the microfiche machine. Is that, that's when you shove the cards in, the card, and you...
Yeah, that's a microfiche. There's also
microfilm.
Film.
I really don't know the difference between
the
two.
That's on a roll that you have like a little wheel that
microfiche just puts it all on a card.
It's a card, and it's just a very, very small, like, picture of like pages that are in
there. So I started thinking, what do I really know about the Korean War, and what do most Americans know about the Korean War, and what impact would the Korean War have on how North Korea views the United States today? I thought those were interesting questions.
Right.
The first question is, anything outside of MASH, I really don't know anything about the Korean War.
Well, I mean, do you really need to know more than that?
Well, was the problem Klinger stayed? Is that why they're so pissed at us all the time? I'm not 100% sure.
You know, the Klinger, it's kind of, if you look at it, it's kind of crazy. So the original movie came out, what was that, probably in the early 70s?
Sutherland, Elliot Gould. Yeah, that had to be early 70s.
Well, I remember watching it when I was a kid. We went to
it's a great movie.
Well, yeah. Well, all I remember is, I remember we went, I was a kid, and we went to a drive-in
theater.
That's
not really a kid's movie.
The point was my parents went, and the kids slept in the back seat. That was kind of, take the kids, put them, make sure about an hour before you get to the theater, you put them on this big sugar high. So that way they just crash. At bedtime when the sun goes down. Not to go off track here, but a movie with a character like Klinger wouldn't play today, or would it? Do you think it would?
A transgender?
He was just cross dressing.
He was, but Klinger's family had a long history of cross dressing to get out of the military.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
He wasn't transgendered. He wasn't fighting to speak his truth of his sexual identity. He wanted out of the military, and he thought the best way to do it was by wearing a dress.
Yeah, that's right. I do. Yeah, to prove to everyone that he was crazy.
So let's go one more step down this side tangent. Who was the first gay character on television?
Oh, I'd have no idea.
Oh, when I say this, you're going to kick yourself.
Remember
Billy Crystal on Soap?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I believe that was the first time on television an openly gay character.
That was a strange program.
That was a great TV show. We were banned from watching it as kids.
Were you?
Because it was too... It had some adult themes to it, right. But it was a very odd TV show.
See, in my family, in our household, the only three television programs I remember in my childhood was All in the Family. Because that was my dad's show. I'd watch that, Appointment Television. On Sunday nights, we always got to watch The Wonderful World of Disney before we went to bed. Like, it was a Sunday at 7 o'clock or something like that as a kid. And the other one, which of course is still a classic if you go Google it today, if you're a young person, is go watch episodes of Laughing.
So, that show's terrible. That show it's terrible. Not funny. It's stupid.
Well, it is stupid. Well, then also Hee Haw. That was another big show.
Oh, I loved Hee Haw. Have you YouTubed and tried to watch some of that stuff now? None of it holds up.
Oh, I tell you, I like, there's that one guy that used to sing that song. Where are you tonight? How can you leave me here all alone?
That's dumb.
You know, when you're a kid, it's funny, And I still laugh when I watch it, but we are on a very long tangent. So let's extend it
to one more place. We're in a golden age of television. Television has never been absolutely
now.
No. Yes. Television has never been better than what it is right now.
It's the golden age of streaming is what it is. It's not the golden age of
television.
No, I disagree with you.
No, you're not watching enough TV.
Because I don't have any free
time. You need to commit
to
watching more TV. When somebody to me says, and I'm stealing this line from Jim Gaffigan, I don't like TV, I just read. It's like, you should really check it out because it's really good. It blows reading out of the water. Sorry. Okay, so back to...
What would be a television show worth watching?
Oh, my God.
See, in this household, we just kind of get a typical parade of, International House Hunters and all that kind of stuff.
Do you watch Game of Thrones?
What is Game of Thrones?
Greatest television show ever. Have you ever watched The Wire?
I don't even... Now, I've actually heard of Game of Thrones, but I've never heard of The Wire.
Have you watched Stranger Things?
No.
Well, then, until you watch those three things, we shouldn't talk.
Now, I'm just going to push on this. Aren't these, I'm just going to make this up, aren't these high production programs that are done for Netflix, not done for commercial television, the way we used to watch when we were kids?
Commercial television is dead.
Okay.
Watching anything on CBS, ABC, I don't even remember them, NBC and Fox, that's silly. There's no reason to do that.
Well, now you're talking from a red state, and we do have sports, so those would be worth watching on those programs.
Sports is live TV. That's a whole different category. Do you watch Westworld?
No. What's that?
Oh my God. Okay.
And you know what? I've never even watched a single episode of The West Wing. How about that? I've heard of it.
This podcast is over, Mike. We're gonna have to do a podcast on just television at some point.
Okay.
But
I mean, an episode, not an entire like committed life of podcasting.
I'm whatever you want to do, because okay. I could do that one too.
Well, clearly I would have nothing to contribute except for laughing and hee-haw. So
I'm on modern golden age of television, and you're stuck on hee-haw.
I'm going to go find one of those episodes, one of those songs.
They're terrible.
They're great. Go
it's
ahead.
Two fat guys in bibs in a cornfield.
No, actually, they usually have like guests. They would come in. Like, you know, Johnny Cash would do one. And then...
Here's something, too. If you watch television shows from the 70s that were popular, and you look at them through the modern lens and kind of the, we'll take the Me Too movement lens, are horrific.
You are right.
The word that my wife uses is, wow, I never realized how rapey this show is.
I've never heard that term. But yeah, there was the political, well, I should say the social norms were different.
Completely different.
And we've progressed since then.
You ever watch like old game shows and half the contestants in celebrity panel are just hammered drunk? That's always fun.
No, that's the roasting things he used to do when Dean Martin would do those.
What's a match game? Remember that where the guy with the real long 70s microphone would ask some slightly sexual suggestive question.
Was it called the match game?
It was, and then the person.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. There'd be three people on the other side.
Yes, and they had the six quasi celebrities. Like Soupy Sales was always like a celebrity.
I don't remember that one. I'm thinking of a different one. There was one that was called the dating game, was what it was called.
There's the dating game.
The dating game was three people and then another person, and then
you had to like finish the line.
Ask questions.
Yeah.
I remember the Soupy Sales one, but that was a different one.
Match Game was pretty horrible.
See, my big game show was the, what was it called? Hollywood Squares. That's what it was.
Paul
Lynde
used
to sit in the middle.
Yes. That's before we knew what gay was, or they advertised what you could not advertise that you were gay. But everybody looked at Paul Lynde and said, man, I don't know. There's something different about that guy.
He was funny.
Did you ever watch the Liberace Variety Hour, like with your grandma?
No.
So when grandma used to babysit us, that was one of her core go-to shows on like Saturday night.
We did have Lawrence Welk, so that's basically the same thing.
Well, I can remember watching the Liberace Variety Hour as like being like six or seven and thinking, I don't know who this guy is, but he doesn't look like any other man. There's something different about him.
Well, let's be careful. No other man in Indiana, I think is what you should say.
Illinois.
Oh, Illinois, sorry.
Same place, basically. Okay. Yeah,
they're both flat and start with the letter I, don't they?
It's like I'm trying to look at other men that I've come in contact with, and my dad and my uncles and teachers. There's something different about this guy.
He was a very talented pianist.
Very talented.
Go ahead.
Why don't we get back to why North Korea hates us?
Okay, I don't know. We should probably cut out this whole 15 minutes.
No.
Okay, go ahead.
I got some feedback on the podcast, too, this week don't be afraid of the hour, because it really doesn't get good until about 30 minutes in.
Well, that's usually when I stop talking, so I think that's probably what's going on.
No, it's by that time we're completely off script, and we're just babbling. So just why would North Korea have this fanatical hatred for the United States? Why would it be important for North Korea to be able to strike the United States mainland with a nuclear weapon? Because again, the idea of Korea launching an attack against us is fairly ridiculous.
Right.
As we would decimate North Korea with any number of techniques in our military arsenal. I just want to run down some facts about what the United States actions were in North Korea when it came to our bombing of the whole Korean peninsula.
Right.
And I'm not making a judgment against what our military did. I'm just throwing out some facts, and we can talk about how North Koreans may have interpreted what we did. So number one, we dropped 635,000 tons of explosives in North Korea.
Wow.
Of that, in that 635,000 tons, 32,557 tons of napalm.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
In the Pacific Theater in World War II, our total tonnage of ordnance dropped was 503,000 tons. And that was over a much larger area.
Yeah.
So if you think about that, in the 2.5-ish years that really North Korea was a war, we dropped more bombs on North Korea and the Korean Peninsula than we did in the entire Pacific Theater of World War II. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Here's the one that really kind of made me really kind of think about this a little bit more. Curtis LeMay, who was the U.S. head of Strategic Air Command, basically when asked about the strategy for carpet bombing in North Korea, basically responded, "We burned down just about every major city in North and South Korea." Wow. "And over a three-year period, killed off 20% of the Korean population."
Wow.
So more Korean civilians died in the Korean War than German civilians and Japanese civilians in World War II.
Really?
Think about that. Over a million Korean civilians died in the Korean War. That's more civilians
now, I mean,
than Germany and Japan.
Well, so my first reaction is I will say that I'm not going to dispute the 1 million number, but I'm not sure that number is accurate about the number of citizens of Germany and Japan. But the point is that a lot of people were killed.
It gives you some
on
scale.
On the peninsula, yes.
It gives you over, I think I read there were 900,000 Japanese civilians died in World War II, and about 700,000 German civilians died in World War II. Russian civilians in World War II, that's a totally different number. They killed them by the millions. This is a comment from Dean Rusk. I have no idea who Dean Rusk is. He served in President Truman's State Department during the Korean War. And he basically said, this was our strategy around bombing in North Korea and on the Korean Peninsula. The U.S. bombed everything that moved in North Korea. Every brick standing on top of another was a target. So he basically said, we bombed every building
twice
and everything that moved. We bombed everything twice. Right. If there was a building or a structure that had two bricks stacked on top of each other, we bombed it.
Well, the reason why we don't know this information is because that wasn't one of the narratives of the movie MASH.
And nobody really cared. And also, too, there was a fair amount... Well, and I can say nobody really cared. There's a fair amount of racism that goes into this.
Well, there's a lot of... I mean, I'm not a historian on Korean War, but I mean, I anecdotally have heard a number of stories. My grandfather served. My father-in-law served in Korea. My dad was a Korea-era veteran, but he served in Europe during that time. And I mean, the thing was, if you think about that time, not to excuse it, but the dynamics, I think, of our collective consciousness around the Korea War. We'd finished World War II.
We were just tired of it.
And we can kick everyone's, and the narrative is we can kick anybody's butt. And then the Korea War happened pretty soon thereafter.
Yeah.
And people were just like, let's get on. Let's get out of this. And then, you know, no less than 10 years later, Vietnam happens. Yeah. And then that becomes the war that everyone wants to talk about. And so, I mean, I remember my father-in-law telling me, there was a kind of a bitter moment when we were talking about veterans. I think it was around the time the Vietnam Memorial was built. And, you know, he was, for a variety of reasons, he was a little bit angry about how much attention Vietnam veterans were given. And because, you know, basically he said is that when I came back from North Korea or from South Korea, we landed in San Francisco. We got off the boat, and I think we got a donut and a cup of coffee.
Yeah, and said, thank you for your service.
Exactly. And he's like, you know, why are we making such a big deal about the Vietnam veterans? Now, I don't share that view, but I mean, it was a different time, and people did want to move on and get along.
To your point, people are exhausted from World War II.
Yeah.
And again, this was an Asian population.
And by the way,
we do no distinction from the Japanese.
Right. And of course, the other big challenge, of course, with the Korean War is it ended in a stalemate. So
correct. There was no winner.
Right. So, you know, you're not going to come home and be excited about, you know, there's no VJ Day or any of that kind of stuff. Yeah. It was a stalemate.
This was a proxy war between the UN, Russia, and China that all just kind of played out on the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah, I don't know the history. I should have done some research on this if I knew we were talking about it. But
historian Charles K. Armstrong, another gentleman who I have no idea who it is, basically, by the fall of 1952, there's nothing left to bomb. 85% of all buildings in Korea have been completely destroyed.
Right.
So do we stop bombing? No. Now we turn our attention to there were 20 dams in North Korea that generated electricity and also controlled flooding around agriculture areas. So since there were no cities left to bomb, because we'd already bombed everything twice, we blew up five of those and flooded massive areas of the country, wiping out their ability to grow food and to feed themselves.
Right. So let me pivot it back to the present. So is Trump going to win a Peace Prize Nobel out of this?
I have no clue. But my point,
and where did that, and where did that come from, by the way? Not to,
oh, it's a Republican talking point. Oh. Well, they're still pissed that Obama won one, like his first year in office, and virtually did nothing. Even Obama's like, I'll take it, but I don't really know
what happened. So, I mean, the narrative, at least in my mind, is that, you know, Trump's being played, and it's not like he's done anything. He's not doing anything that's, or is he, or should we give him credit that this is actually his master plan was to get Korea back to the table, and this is how it's going to work?
Well, for me, this was interesting because we talked about this before the pod. The analogy that we think of America is viewed universally as we are the coolest kid in high school. We're the best looking. We're the most popular. Our parents have the most money. We drive the cool cars.
I'm not sure that's true everywhere, but I know where you're going with
should
this.
See us. Uh-huh. And we never stop and think about how some of our actions have impacted the way people view America.
Right.
The thing, too, I thought was interesting about this, I read something that those facts and the facts of the Korean War are drilled into every North Korean citizen. And it helps kind of understand when you see on cable, like some cable news show, they play one of those ridiculous ads that they've pulled off of North Korean state news about how they're going to rain hellfire down on us. And you're like, what in the world does that come from?
Right.
Maybe it comes from that 70-ish, close to 70 years ago, we bombed their country flat. We blew up every single building, and by our own admission, killed off 20% of their citizenry.
Right.
I'm not saying that justifies anything Kim Jong-il or Kim Jong-un have done. Those are two lunatics that do things like execute their family members with VX gas.
Right.
They have killed political rivals by having them attacked by dogs. This in no way is a defense for anything North Korea has done. But if you want to kind of understand the deep feeling of resentment and anger and fear that North Korea on a daily basis still feels towards the United States, maybe it has something to do with in 1950, we literally blew up everything.
Right.
And we did it with no regard to civilian life.
Wow.
We did not say we want to minimize civilian casualties. We went in there and just bombed the shit out of everything.
So what is this? Where do we want to go with this? Then we would talk about.
I think that it's a big wait and see on Trump and what we're doing with them right now. I'm under the impression that they'll give up their nuclear program because they've accomplished everything they wanted to accomplish, which is to prove that they had the ability to do so. We talked about what they really want is what China wants, what North and South Korea wants is the U.S. military presence off of the Korean Peninsula.
Right.
After 70 years, it's probably time to go.
Yeah. All right, so there was another thing that happened in D.C. in the last week, which my lack of free time has prevented me from getting a firsthand look at it. But apparently, every so often, White House correspondents get together.
Once a year.
And they have a dinner.
Gotta have a dinner. And for the second year in a row, didn't go.
You know, sometimes you have pressing campaign events to do.
God. The fact that he's normalized that whatever those rallies are, and that a year ago or 6 months ago, they were surprising and shocking and worth talking about. And now it's just like, well, there's the president of the United States getting up and babbling for 2.5 hours, spewing out a bunch of junk that we're just going to let that pass.
Well, you know what? You're not a what's it called? What's World Wrestling? What's it called?
WWE.
Now?
It's like a WWE event.
Yeah. So, I mean, Isn't it basically the same? You know, you just have something come to town. Everyone knows how it's going to come out, and you know everyone has a good time, has a couple beers, you know, beg back popcorn, and you know it was fun.
So, Mike, give me the visual cue here if I'm about ready to get myself or the pod in trouble.
You've taken your glasses off, so this has never happened
so
in my presence.
Of President Obama going to Detroit or Atlanta or predominantly Black City, let's say. And
wow, you are going to go there, aren't you?
Filling up an arena with 25,000 black people and giving one of those speeches.
Fire and Fury speeches.
And I'm going to say maybe speaking in a way, speaking in, let's say, a... I don't know.
This is really dangerous.
Let's say President Obama suddenly started speaking in a very black dialect, started speaking about topics that were specific to the population in front of him, and doing it in very crude and very aggressive terms. What would our reaction to that be?
Well, I think collectively the country would not like that.
Yeah, that's one way to say it.
Fox would go off the air because every single correspondent, their head would explode. They would be unable. They'd have to like start up three more channels just to get all the coverage in, because there'd be so much to talk about.
But when you try to take those things and put them in context of other presidents, you can't. And it's like the fact that we just all kind of blow past that anymore is really strange.
Well, and they talked about this at the session I was at last night. By the way, American Public Square, great nonprofit here in Kansas City, trying to have sane conversations from people that have disagreements.
Yeah. Good luck.
Who was the author's name? You remembered his name. He talked to the
David Frum.
Yeah. He's got a new book about Trumpocracy. And he was talking about this issue about how, what he say is that, about how the norm has changed and how, like, it's crazy how far it's gone. And the question is, what's going to happen next? Are we going to swing back or go further? And his point was that he goes, you know, I think he served in George Bush, so second Bush White House. He said that, you know, if it would have been during the election, or the election when George got elected, when he was running against Al Gore, if George Bush would have been handed information that the Russians wanted to have a meeting with them, and that they would like coordinate around the campaign. He said, you know, he goes, I can tell you, because I was in that White House, there is absolutely no way that the first thing they would have done is they would report it to the FBI. I mean, they would have gone to the right law enforcement and say, okay, these people are trying to, because in fact, we probably would have even called Al Gore to tell him it was happening. Okay. And so he's like, and now it's been, you know, whatever, 15 years, and the yardstick has moved so far that, like, and it's like, they're just incredibly corrupt, and then they just, so I don't want to go into Russia today, but it really could calls back to the point that, like, if you look, I like the analogy, I'm glad you went there, but, you know, to basically say if Obama would have done a similar thing, there would have been an immense amount of distaste, and it would have been bad. I mean, people would have had a really, really awful reaction to that.
Trump has built his base kind of off tribalism of white Americans who feel displaced by the economy.
Right.
What if Barack Obama, he would have been president if he had tried this, would have tried to do the same with dissatisfied, displaced African Americans?
Right.
He'd been branded a radical, somebody, you know, way to the left. He never would have been elected president. That strategy doesn't work. But as president, when you see him playing to the bases and kind of poking that bear over and over and over, and you try to put that in the context of another presidency, it just doesn't work.
Well, and I you know, I'm not going to, I don't mean to.
And it's gross.
Well, it's gross. And I don't mean to be critical of the press, but in some ways I think they like it, because it does give them a lot. I mean, I read more Washington Post and New York Times than I've ever read in my entire life, because there's so much, every day there's something new. Whereas in the past there really wasn't as much to read, if that makes any sense.
Because they like
the attention. CNN's the same way.
Maybe because we're 3 years into this, I just can't think back to when this wasn't the norm. But literally, there's been weeks we put this podcast together, and there's 75 topics we could choose from. That if any of these things would have happened at any other time, these would dominate national headlines.
Right.
But to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, you know, this is again once a year. It's in some ways a big stroke session for the press, and they all get together and slap each other on the back. And basically the goal is for the president, the White House, and the press all to get together in a more informal setting and make fun of each other and have a ha-ha moment. Obama was fantastic at these, because he could deliver some pre-written funny lines. He was good at the speech. He was good at a presentation. And generally, and again, I will freely admit this, the press liked Obama.
Yeah.
There was a cozy relationship and a familiar relationship between the president and the media.
Right.
That's completely flipped under Trump. Trump doesn't go to these things.
Well, it's, you know, the silver lining of this, and the silver lining is that I do think the awfulness is making all of us ask the question, how can we be better citizens?
But here's what's strange. So Trump doesn't go to these things. So he throws Sarah Huckabee Sanders and Kellyanne Conway. I think he does this specifically because they're women. And he knows the rules of the game for attacking women are very different. He puts those two in play. So when the press is really there looking for the red meat to attack Trump, and the main person doesn't show up, and he throws two of his underlings out, now you have to sit there and take it. And since you're not the president, you really can't punch back. So there's a comedian, Michelle Wolf. I think she's a writer for Trevor Noah on Comedy Central. She did a 20-minute dialogue, which is very standard fare for these events.
Yeah,
I didn't find it. I thought it was funny. There was a joke about abortion that I thought was disgusting, ooh, out of line. And I thought that's what they would be angry over, the press. But they focused in on she made some jokes at Sarah Huckabee Sanders' expense. The main one being is that she burns lies and uses it to make a perfect smoky eye, the ashes, to put her makeup on. And the line was, is it lies or is it Maybelline? Well, it's lies. And they made a reference to something about she had a hard time getting there because of her job on The Handmaid's Tale. You don't know what that means because it's a modern TV show and you haven't watched anything since Hee Haw.
Oh, it's a Game of Thrones reference. I get it.
Handmaid's Tale, not never mind. So the media portrays this as they were attacking her physical appearance. I didn't get any of that from well, anything
it,
that
it
was
goes,
said.
It goes back to one of the big narratives we use in politics today is the whataboutism. You know, it's like, well, you said that, but, you know, and it's kind of referencing back and forth. And I know that they've done it both directions. It's like, well, they attacked her, and so now we need to point out how, you know, this liberal person attacked the Republicans, but then the Democrats come out and say, but then remember Trump said all these awful things about these other people. And it just, actually what I've decided to do on stuff like that is I don't pay attention to it. Then maybe it'll just go away.
Can we both agree that Sarah Huckabee Sanders consistently lies, misleads, or half-truths?
I think Sarah probably has one of the hardest jobs in the whole country.
Absolutely. She may have the hardest. Here's my point. Number one, you can't stand in front of that group almost every day and do the job she does and in the way she does it and not expect some blowback. Also, too.
Well, and I agree with that. People need to understand that when they live out in the public life and they say something, they need to remember that they're responsible for that. And if they're uncomfortable with the reaction they get, then maybe they should rethink what they're doing.
Trump 101 is if you say something that later you learn people find offensive, you say you should get a sense of humor. I was just joking. Here's four examples of Sarah Huckabee Sanders defending Trump's actions by saying that was only a joke. This is kind of a rundown memory lane for us, so I think you'll like this. Remember when Trump challenged Tillerson to an IQ test off?
Yeah, I remember that.
Well, obviously he was joking.
I think I may have actually tweeted. This was before I was running. I think actually I said I would accept that challenge. I think
we both did.
I think we did. You're right. It's right.
Hey, remember when Trump at the State of the Union address accused Democrats of treasonous behavior?
Yeah, I do.
That's a ha ha. He's joking.
He's just joking.
I'm serious. Remember when he made the comment to the Long Island Police Association about don't worry about roughing up a suspect when
that was awful. I remember
that. You want to bang his head off the car door? Just go ahead and do that.
Yeah, I think he even repeated that again at like
multiple
some,
times.
You know,
that was a funny. That was a joke.
And he did it to play to the crowd.
Absolutely,
it was one of those campaign rally things.
Hey, remember when recently Trump said that one of the ways that Japan gets around importing American cars is they take a bowling ball from 2 feet and drop it on the car, and if it leaves a dent, they don't allow it in the country, and that's a way they control how many automobiles they get into the market.
Yeah,
he was joking. My point is that Sarah Huckabee Sanders on multiple times has sidestepped issues by saying people need to grow a sense of humor. He's joking. When that's one of your go-to moves and your boss sends you as a lamb to slaughter to that dinner, you sit there and take everything thrown at you. And then in the
because we actually do know that a comedian is only joking.
Absolutely. And here's the problem, too, is that when you want to bust out the funny and say, I was joking, when eventually you meet somebody who is a professional comedian, wow, they can do it at a level that you can't do.
Well, and they're actually doing it purposely to be funny, whereas he's actually just using it as a way to get out of saying something awful.
That's their job, yeah. And they're always going to be better at it than you.
They're good at it.
But this gets to the point, too. How do we stop this cycle? How do we get out of the whataboutism? I did something, you did something.
Here's my tip. Mr. Trump, act presidential, and then we can go talk about the issues as opposed to all this other garbage. How about that idea?
There's several flaws in your logic. First one being, hey, Mr. Trump, ask presidential.
So act presidential. Are you going back to more notes? I was going to transition us over to being presidential with your legal team.
This is a quote from Einstein. Weak people revenge, strong people forgive, intelligent people ignore.
Well, there you have it. So actually, that's a compliment because I just said I was ignoring all this.
That's right. When do we just start?
What was the steps? Step one was
weak people revenge, strong people forgive, intelligent people ignore.
So where do you fit on that scale when it comes to like your free time and how much stuff you spend on this? Do you forgive him?
For me personally, forgive him? I'm somewhere between the weak. I'm a high weak that sometimes maybe I can get into strong. I'm rarely into the ignore.
Okay.
And if we're doing Trump, he's a hard W on that.
He is a hard
W. Well, he's just a counterpuncher. So, I mean, when people counterpunch you have to take that.
So and that's where Michelle got her, we take the high road.
When they go low, we go high.
And
nobody goes high.
I've tweeted recently that... Yeah, take the high road. It's generally less crowded.
Wow.
How about that one?
That's right up there with the Einstein thing.
That's a pearl
thing,
of wisdom.
Dude.
You know, if you get a pearl of wisdom 57 minutes into a podcast, it's a pretty big deal.
You've been sitting there just eyeballing our time the whole time.
Well, no, not the whole time. I realized that we did the fluffy 25 minutes at the beginning of me talking about the campaign, which I basically just did a bunch of like word salad, and like then we never got into the real topics of the day. So Trump legal team, it seems like there's a little bit of that going on here as we wind down to this week's episode. Whether it be is this kind of, what was the name of that movie? I'm sorry, my cultural references are just so off because I don't
strong. Mike, you are showing the audience how much you are engaged in the modern day pop culture.
I said
Game of Thrones, and you kind of recognized that.
I know of it.
You didn't know what Stranger Things
what
was.
Wasn't there a movie series like called Mockingjay or something?
I'm not answering that.
Like a competition if someone was left at the end kind of a thing?
Are you being serious right now?
I am being serious.
You don't know the Hunger Games movies.
Hunger Games, that's it.
Who starred in the Hunger Games, Mike?
I have no idea.
Oh, my God.
So is the Trump legal team like a Hunger Games kind of thing? That is like whoever is left, you know, now we've got Giuliani's coming in, and so now, you know, what's the guy's? I always call him Ty Cobb, but that's not his name, not the baseball player.
Wyatt Cobb? No.
No, it's not Wyatt
Cobb. No, it is Ty Cobb.
It is Ty Cobb, yeah. So not the baseball player Ty Cobb.
No.
And he's not Wyatt Earp, or there's a whole bunch of people.
He's got the curly
He's got the Hanistar mustache.
Which I think that has a specific name in hipster language.
It's called a handlebar mustache.
No, it's something else. There's a lot of, young hipster men are going with that look.
Well, and I would say that, by the way, most young hipster men have probably never had a handlebar bike. What do they call those big ape hangers. What do they call them?
In the motorcycle world, they're called ape hangers because you got your arms up like this and you're hanging like an ape. That's how cool I am, Mike. I'll bust that out.
You know, I tell you, I'm feeling very vulnerable at this moment. I really don't know. I don't know anything. I don't know the biker culture. I don't know what was the Hunger Games. I don't know Game of Thrones. I have to tell you, when I worked at water.org, Jody would actually like feed me like People Magazine stories. So in case I was ever alone and
enough,
for a long, wait a second.
People Magazine.
Well, no, there's
God's
a point
sake.
To this. So like at water.org, Matt Damon was one of our co-founders. And so there would be on very rare.
You've never told a good Matt Damon story on the pod either, by the way.
Well, there's a couple, but there were very rare moments, not very often.
And when's he going
to
be a guest?
Well, I have to. It's a cliffhanger. You know, you got to come on to the next episode, maybe. But there are moments where I knew that I'd be in a meeting or at a dinner that I might actually accidentally be standing next to Matt Damon and have to make conversation with the man, and I was terrified.
Did he know your name?
Yeah, he did. Okay. Yes, he did. He. A nice guy, super nice guy, just like an everyday person, just the best. But Jody would always feed me People Magazine stories, so that way, like, if I'm sitting there talking to him, I can say, hey, Matt, you know, I heard you guys, you know, sold your house in Miami, you're moving up to, you know, New York City, how do you like living in the city? And, like, this is stuff that I would have no idea. So I was able to kind of, my wife was able to keep me kind of in the cool when it came to, like, the moments when I might be standing around talking to Matt.
So I'm trying to figure out the scenario where you're in Congress and you have to go to something where there's like, current pop culture people there.
Well, see, here's the deal. I'm going to hire you and bring you with me. So that way,
because you would be like, you know, well, oh, cool. Is Gomer and Goomer from Hee Haw going to pop out a cornfield on me and sing a song? Mike, what rap artist just won the Pulitzer?
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Isn't there? I do know there's. I have no idea.
Kendrick Lamar.
I can't even. I couldn't even name a single person that is in that industry. I couldn't even name a single person.
Name one rap. Name one hip hop / rap artist, and Will Smith doesn't count.
Eminem. Eminem.
Oh, I should have picked Eminem.
No, I don't. Well, isn't what's that one guy's name from Pitbull? He doesn't do any rapping, does he? No. So
Pitbull is the People Magazine of rap. All right, let's change topics because this is getting
so. Now let's just let me defend myself after we roll off of this real quick.
Feel free.
So I mean I am kind of up on the pop music. So you know. Well, when you have a 17-year-old daughter in your house, you have to pay attention to some of this stuff.
So your 17-year-old daughter doesn't listen to Kendrick Lamar or Travis Scott or Post Malone.
I have not heard any of those names.
Flyover is Saturday, which is a massive kind of pop culture
rap.
I
thought flyovers were like when airplanes flew over like things. They do that at the beginning of the Chiefs game. That's a flyover, right?
We need to have a whole podcast on. We have to hit mic up, and we can have listeners of the pod send us things that to educate you on in a pop culture sense.
Well, I it is a blind spot for me because I don't know it.
You need to commit yourself next week to watching 15 hours of television.
Well, I'll see if I can work that into my life.
Sunday, Westworld, HBO is a good start.
All right, real quick. So let's talk about Legal Team and wind this up this week. So
what's weird is, Ty Cobb leaves. That was one of Trump's main attorneys, and he was always, let's cooperate. He was the guy, if you remember, said, hey, this Mueller probe's going to wrap up in the fall.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
If we just go in and talk to him and turn everything over, this will get past us. He's been kicked to the curb, and somebody who now is one of the lead attorneys is Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah.
So most people know Rudy Giuliani, but was the United States attorney for the Southern District of New York. So he has some DOJ background. He does have a background as an attorney, although he's not there for his legal expertise. He's there more as a political person and a political operative. Hence, last night he goes on Hannity and compares the FBI to Nazis.
Wow.
If you need someone to get out in front of a story who will say anything and do anything to remain relevant, that's what Rudy Giuliani is these days. He's the only person in Trump's orbit who, after the Access Hollywood tape came out, who still went on a Sunday talk show and defended Trump. So if he's already come out, Comey needs to be prosecuted. Mueller needs to be needs to be disbanded. The FBI and the DOJ level of corruption is unbelievable. I mean, he's going, the attacks and the tempo of Trump defending himself through Giuliani is going to pick up big time.
Well, I'm not looking forward to that. I'd like for this thing to be over with so we can get back to actually trying to solve problems.
I think. And then Trump also hired the guy's name. I think his last name is Flint. He hired the attorney that Clinton
had
his impeachment. So it feels like they're kind of hardening their war council, and they know
it's coming.
The end game is in play, and the end game is Mueller talking to Trump. And there's this thing of these leaked questions, and that was silly. Trump's team leaked those out because right. by leaking them out, you have 36 hours of Fox News telling you this is unconstitutional, this is illegal, right. and this is evidence of corruption in the right. DOJ and FBI.
Right. Yeah, there are so many stories, and I'll swing back to the campaign as I kind of wind this up today, but I just wish that we would talk about things that matter and how we're going to fix people's problems. And this all so much of this stuff, you know, we talk about the White House Correspondents' Dinner, we talk about Trump going to rallies, we talk about his legal team. You know, it's all just like it's like a three-ring circus, and they're trying to distract you away from like the things that really matter. You know, we're not talking about ICE and the reign of terror that they're doing in neighborhoods, even yeah. in Kansas City, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, we're not talking about affordable health care and how we're going to do that. You know, I heard last night 3.2 million people don't have health insurance that did at the beginning of the Trump administration. And we're not talking about any of that stuff because there's not enough oxygen. There's not enough airtime no. to talk about it, because we got to talk about some leaked questions from some legal proceeding that really, you know, the average person doesn't really necessarily need to know much about, because at the end yeah. of the day, this is like the news. This is the news about the news that might become the news, you know, so it's not even like the news, if that makes any sense.
So I listened to each podcast multiple times. And one of the things that the last two or three podcasts I've ended on an incredibly cynical, negative note. And just to keep my streak alive.
Oh, man.
The reason why we don't concentrate on that stuff and why the sideshow and the culture stuff is so important. Mike, name me one big thing we've solved in the last 30 years. Give me one big topic
I would say
that we've solved.
I would say that we actually made a lot of progress on healthcare under Obama, under the Affordable Care Act.
Which we immediately now have started dismantling.
Well, and I think that's a very interim, like, reaction, but I think genuinely speaking, it's actually pretty much still in place, and it was a very good piece of legislation.
So that's one. Mm-hmm. There's tons of debate on that.
Oh yeah, of course.
I'll give you that one.
Okay.
Struggle to give me one more.
You know, when I think of the topics of today, you know, the issues that I hear on the campaign trail when it comes to gun violence or immigration, affordable housing.
Sir, that wasn't the question.
I know. I'm just saying. I can't. I'm agreeing with you. I can't think of anything substantive that has actually happened and that actually is stuck. I mean, they tried to do banking reform no. after the big financial crash.
Let me just dismantle that.
And so it's Yeah, they talked about it the other day. I mean, like, a lot of the progress of the last 30 or 50 years is being undone as we speak by the current administration.
When maybe when you give up a little bit, that big things are out of our reach right now, this is what's left. And we elevate these things because we can talk about guns till we're blue in the face. We have talked about guns till we're blue in the face. Nothing has changed.
Nothing has changed with that.
We can talk about climate change and what we should be doing. We've taken a big step back from that. We're not right. we're not going to do anything.
Right.
Pick any number of other topics that have been around since you and I in our early 20s probably first became politically aware.
Right.
Name me two that anything's happened on.
Yeah, it's been yeah, it is what it is. So I'll end it on a high note. So you can either sit around and bitch about it or try to do something. So go do something about it. Go do something about it. Go try to get register more people to vote or start a conversation with someone. Or I said, you know what, I need to run. You know, that's my one of my responses to this is, okay, these people are awful. I disagree with them. I don't think they're representing who I am or the people I know and the people I care about. So I'm going to run for office. And you know what? I might lose. I might win. You know, and if I win, then I figure out what to do after that. Thank you for listening to this week's podcast, and be sure to subscribe through your favorite store. Visit our website, the2minintheMiddle.com, for historical episodes and more about the podcast. Likewise, you can find us on Twitter at the2minintheMiddle for show updates and upcoming episodes. Thanks for stopping by, and have a great week.